It's time for the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed on the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
I'd be rich.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Good morning, John Graney.
Good morning, Larry Lexo. How are we today?
I couldn't be any better. I'll tell you, April Fool's is such a fun time last week.
I know. We have some fun things to talk about, sort of, but nothing like April Fool's. That was a fun show.
That was a fun show. And, you know, write us and tell us what trick you played on your family or at work. We're just, you know, we might save those for next year and share them with everybody. So just let us know. You can send them to LexoNickelFinancial.com or JGraney@NickelFinancial.com.
And if you missed the show and you would like to catch it, because we did laugh quite a bit, I almost choked on my coffee. You can go to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us. And all of our shows are podcasted out there. And you can find, did you call it April Fool's?
I did. April Fool's and healthcare.
April Fool's and healthcare. And they're interchangeable, those terms.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
but
pretty
yes,
much.
You can go out there and catch any of our previous episodes. But that one was a good one. We did have fun with that one for sure.
We almost ran out of time, John.
I know. We didn't even get to do our strange news stories indeed.
So much material to cover.
We had so many practical jokes to share with everybody.
But it was so much fun.
I never even got to share my practical joke that I pulled when I was an employee on my boss.
Okay. We'll give you one. Go ahead, John.
So, let's see. This was a long time ago. But anyway, we were coming up on April Fool's Day, and I wanted to pull a prank on my boss. So what I did was I had one of our assistants make a comment to our boss saying, "Is John leaving the firm?" I heard him on the phone talking to so-and-so, or I think the name was this, and my boss knew that I was good friends with this person, and that person had been trying to get me to come over there for several years. So, and then I conveniently left his business card with some other business cards from that organization on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
And we come back from lunch, and I knew everything was in play. And I could almost feel him stewing. And he eventually comes in and says, "Let's go get a cup of coffee." And I decided to prolong the agony and said, "I'm sorry, I got way too much to do." Went back to his office. 15 minutes later, came back and said, "We're going to get a cup of coffee now." I said, "Okay, fine." So we get on the elevator to walk down the street to go to a Starbucks. And he proceeds to say things along the lines of, "You know, we have this agreement, and, you know, if I was leaving, I would share it with you." And I said, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." I never responded, never indicated anything. We get back from the coffee, and you could almost see the steam coming out of the office because he was so angry.
And so how many people were in on this?
Everyone in the office knew.
Except him. Okay.
So I stood up, came out of my cubicle, went to his office, as everyone kind of gathered around, huddled around, and I went, "April Fools," and ran, because he was mad.
Was he throwing something at the door as you left?
I was gone before. I mean, as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was running back down the hallway, away from his office.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone had a kick out of that one, and there was nothing he could really do other than to kind of chuckle and call me a few choice names.
Yeah, until the next Ray's review.
Yeah, we'll see who's funny now. Uh-huh. Come here, funny boy.
Uh-huh. All right.
So, we didn't get to share that one. We ran out of time, but that was my – I probably my best prank that I've played on
anybody. That's pretty good. I will give you that.
So today, in the market segment, I found an article, and we haven't really touched on it, but Brexit. The British, the UK leaving the European Union. And the article says, three ways today's triggering of Brexit will change Britain and Europe. So what I thought we could do is talk a little bit about what is the European Union. It's no relation to the euro.
And why?
I'm sorry?
And why?
And why?
There's a European Union.
Yes. Talk about that a little bit and then get into, because they made such a big deal that this would have huge ramifications across the market and blah, blah, blah. It's not really so. But what is the EU? Can you name all 28 countries in the European Union?
Not a chance.
Okay, neither could I. Though I thought it was funny, when I look at the map of the European Union, Switzerland is the only non-participating
member?
Yes.
Yeah. Imagine
but
that.
There are 28 countries that make up the European Union. What I did not realize about it was it is actually the largest economy in the world.
Really?
Is the largest, the union, all 28 countries, is the largest economy.
Now, that surprises me.
It covers 7.3% of the world's population and 22.2% of global GDP, gross domestic product.
That's
what
pretty
the goods and services that countries produce. So it's almost a quarter of global GDP. I had no idea.
That's pretty significant because as I think about the European Union and many of the countries that are in there, geographically speaking, if you put them all together, they're still going to be less than the geography of the United States.
Oh, I wonder. Uh-huh. It says here that
there's a question. If you know the answer, LXO, nickelfinancial.com, or jgraney at nickelfinancial.com.
It covers, it has an area of 4,475,757 kilometers squared.
Okay, there's a challenge. Continue.
Or 1,728,099 square miles. Population of 510 million, which is larger than the U.S.
That's, yeah, okay, I'll buy that.
Yeah, you were thinking China there for a second with B
yeah,
billions.
Really.
But, yeah, so it's a pretty big deal, the European Union. And not to be confused with the euro. The euro is a currency that 19 of the 28 countries use for their money, if you will. Britain is not one of them. They are still on the pound, sterling. So
Britain did not adopt
the euro.
The euro.
Nope.
I did not know that.
Nope, they did not. So What does all this mean with Britain leaving the European Union? One of the reasons why, and it should sound familiar, but they wanted to grow the exports from Britain. And in order to do that, they had to get out of the European Union. That was holding them back. So their departure will devalue the euro. I mean, devalue their currency against the euro, and that will help with their exports and make their economy stronger. So that was one of the main goals. But essentially what the European Union does is it just provides another layer of rules, regulations, everything that these participating countries have to follow. And it was created to ensure the free movement of people, goods, services, and capital within the internal market, within the union itself. But if you were to look at the map of Europe, it covers almost all of Europe, Great Britain, Spain, Italy, some of the Netherlands countries, but does not cover Switzerland. Did you find out the square mileage of the United States?
No, I have to refine my search here. I'm working on it. Keep going.
Okay. So there's 19, 20 in Europe. Folks, it's going to take about 2 years, if not longer, to complete this whole exit. So there's nothing really today that we need to worry about. As I mentioned, it will strengthen the UK economy, so strengthen their exports, which is something that Trump has wanted to do here in the United States. He wants to weaken the dollar So he can increase our exports, which will then help bring jobs back to the United States and make our economy stronger. There is a bit of protectionism, and there's a lot of that going on in various countries. There will be less tax and regulations ahead for Britain because the EU has significant tax and regulations on the participating countries. The actual union itself, they think, will become more unified. Doesn't seem to be that anyone else is leaving. France and Germany have talked about it. But in total, the European Union will now be weaker. It will be less influential because, I mean, Britain was a major part of it. Another aspect of this that I did not think about is U.S. and China will now be vying for the largest economy because Britain's pull will reduce the EU, and the EU will no longer be the most influential, most powerful economy in the world.
Okay, I found a size. In square miles, the United States, including all of the United States, is 3,794,083 square miles.
So this is half.
So the Eastern Union is half of the U.S.
About half.
And do you know what the number one state in the United States is for square mileage?
Texas or Alaska?
Alaska. Alaska's number one at 663,000 square miles. Texas is a distant south at 268,000 miles. And then California is even half of that. So,
wow, Alaska's big.
Geography lesson for today.
You never know what you're going to get with us, folks.
Thinking back, though, John, and this, you know, I didn't prepare a lot for this discussion, but from my readings, as I recall, the euro came about in the 80s. I don't know if that's reflected in your study material, but it was in, I believe it was in the 80s that it was first talked about, and Britain was one of the countries that was not in favor of going to the euro as a common means of currency, and indeed predicted that it would not work. And many of the things that the powers that be, the Prime Minister of England, said back then have indeed come true some 20, 30 years later.
Do you think the euro started in the 80s or the European Union? The currency or
the European Union, I think.
Yes, the European Union actually started in the first few states were 6 countries in 1951.
Wow.
But the last one to enter was 2009.
In the euro?
Treaty of Lisbon came into force in 2009. The euro started January 1, 1999. That's the currency, the European Currency Unit, ECU.
So almost 20 years ago. So it's been a 20-year experiment with the euro. And as again, I think the articles that I had seen was that there was a lot of prognostication about the failure of it. And indeed, the Brexit, I believe, has brought to fruition the result of many of those concerns.
Well, I think when you look at it, the smaller countries banding together makes sense.
It does.
But when you have countries like Germany, Great Britain, and France to some degree.
Not so small.
They end up bearing the brunt of a lot of this. And it costs them money to support and keep the union and for those that participate in the euro afloat. And that's a taxing, no pun intended, venture for them. And I think Britain said enough's enough. We can be stronger going back and being on our own, which is exactly what they want to do. So again, there's nothing to worry about per se. Again, it's going to take a couple years. Some even speculate that it will take even longer because they have to essentially pay their way out. But then they also have to be paid for what they have paid back, what they have put into the European Union. So I can't imagine.
Might be a net-net.
I can't imagine any of that is going to be done quickly.
No, we know that.
So, folks, let's not get all bent out about the Brexit. And I wanted to get on to the next topic, which is the topic of the week, which is brought to us by
The Chef Shop. Hey, Scott and Nancy Schneider with The Chef Shop, located in Edwardsville. Gourmet kitchen store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day outright. And that can't be truer, because probably one of the first things I do in the morning is to go into the kitchen and get a fresh cup of coffee, preparing for the day. And they have a wide variety of coffees. I don't think I've found any of them that are not my favorites, although there is probably one or two of the real strong ones that John is certainly a major favor of.
Yes.
For example, you know, the Highland or Grog is pretty pretty strong. The Aztec Harvest Organic is, but I pretty much like all of them. The Sumatra is another one, but I do like it. You know, Sumatra is a full body with a fruity, earthy undertones, intense flavor, full body, light acidity, and rich aroma. So stop in and see Nancy and see Scott at the Chef Shop located in Edwardsville. We appreciate them underwriting our shows on a continuing basis. Gosh, we're about, 9 months into this now, John. So we're going to have a full year of shows here in the very near future. Chef Shop is a continuing sponsor located at 2320 Troy Road, Edwardsville, in the Schnucks Plaza right next to Target. Their phone, 618-659-9840. Easter is coming up. Get out there. Check out the Easter bunnies. Check out all of the fun things that they have leading up to Easter. And, of course, the candy. Can't bypass the candy. Lots of candy for Easter, as well as the popcorn. I don't know. Do they have an Easter popcorn? I'll have to check that out and see if...
Jelly bean popcorn?
Maybe jelly bean popcorn. That would be a good way to go for Easter. So go visit them a little bit. Let them know you heard us on the show. We will have our thermal coffee cups there shortly. If you get in before they are, then leave your email address, your phone number. We'll get a hold of you and make sure that you get your coffee cup and a T-shirt, if you so choose, for listening to the show. So let us know, but stop by and see them at the Chef Shop.
You're done?
I'm done.
Good job.
Thank you.
So, topic of the week. I came across this article, and it's something that I've been wanting to talk about for a while. And April will be our investment month, so we'll be talking about different terms, ideas, notions, ways of investing, and so forth for the month of April. The article said, "Why active investing matters." You've all heard of what came first, the chicken or the egg. There's lots of arguments like that.
Which came first?
I don't know.
Oh, me neither.
I'm just doing active versus passive.
Why'd the chicken cross the road?
But there has been lots of arguments about the investment style, investment approach between active management versus passive management. So, Mr. Larry, give me your best definition of passive management.
Passive management, by definition, implies that there is using the indexes, the Standard & Poor's 500, the Russell, the various indexes, to try and not beat, but to mimic or to follow the return of those specific indexes, the 500 stocks in the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000 with the 1000 or 2000 with 2000 of the issues in that. So you're trying to achieve a level of performance equal to a particular index without a lot of buying and selling within a particular category.
Very good. Very good. There are about a gazillion indexes out there.
Yeah.
Especially with the advent of ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, which we'll talk about another day this month. But passive management is the low cost, because there isn't active trading. The manager merely mirrors whatever index they're benchmarking or comparing their results to or tracking. Active management is very different. Active management is you're paying a manager to beat a certain index, to outperform an index. And so you could have a large cap growth manager who is trying to outperform the S&P 500 growth, which would be the S&P 500 index, pull out all the growth stocks of that index, create the growth index, and then this manager is going to try and beat that. The drawbacks with that is some of your trading costs will be higher. The, you got to pay that manager. They're going to be more, the underlying expense ratio will be more expensive. So which one is better? Which approach should we be using with our investments? I will say that when I started out in my career 20 years ago.
So what? How long? 20 years ago? Okay.
A little bit ago, 20 yeah, years ago. Yeah. That I was all about active management. You know, guns a-blazing, beat the index. I have softened as I have gotten older. And since most of my business, most of my clients, 99.99% of them are retirement plans, 401k plans, I have become a passive manager. And there are, I have a total here of 5 different studies that are trying to determine is passive management or active management a better approach. But before we can do that, the way that these studies were completed was looking at something called asset allocation. How is a portfolio allocated across different types of stocks, different types of bonds, whatever the underlying investments may be? Have you heard of the Bebauer-Brinson study, Mr. Lexo?
I can honestly say no.
Okay. Now, my world, that was a big study. Have you heard of Harry Markowitz?
I have heard of Harry Markowitz.
Harry Markowitz. Yeah,
definitely.
He's considered the pioneer of modern portfolio theory.
Absolutely.
But that was back in the 50s, so I don't know how modern it really is anymore. Yeah, but anyway, they still say that. So the Bebauer-Brinson-Hood study was published, the determinants of portfolio performance. And so there's these 3 gentlemen. They did this study. And what they did was they tracked 91 large pension funds from 1974 to 1983. And they determined that the variation of return of portfolio returns, 93.6% of the variation in portfolio returns was attributed to asset allocation. The remaining part was attributed to market timing, luck, stock selection, and so forth. But they determined that basically asset allocation drove the variance of performance returns. They then again in 1991 did the same study again. However, they looked at returns from 1977 through 1987, and that study came back with 91.5% versus 93.6% of the variation of portfolio returns being attributed to asset allocation. William Jahnke in 1997 said, wait a second, hold on here. These studies focus on return volatility, not portfolio returns. They said that the industry was misrepresenting the information presented by the Bebauer-Brinson study. And he then went and did a study to try and prove that portfolio returns is it being attributed to something else other than asset allocation. To me, in simple language, I am a big proponent of the KISS theory. But to me, in order to have volatility of returns, there has to be an average. They have to have a mean to have your volatility around, which would then indicate that that's the portfolio's return. But anyway, he was not happy with it. He contended that what he looked at was, I took 2 portfolios with the same allocation. I used different funds and we'll have different results. And to some degree, he came back, his study came back saying that only 40% was attributed to asset allocation, not
90 plus.
Right, not 90 plus. So how it's hard to compare the two because I don't think Jahnke's study was quite as robust as far as the Bebauer looking at 91 pension funds, which have huge amounts of underlying. Anyway, in 2000, Ibbotson and Kaplan, they wrote a report called Does Asset Allocation Policy Explain 40, 90, or 100% of Performance Results? And I have that one.
Just so happen to have that study.
I have all of the studies. Mm-hmm. And I read all of them. And
why am I not surprised?
It was, for me, fascinating. for everyone else, if you're having insomnia, the pi would be material to read, but I get into the mathematical statistical side. Anyway, what they did was Ibbotson and Kaplan, pretty big names in the investment industry, they looked at 10 years of monthly returns for 94 balanced funds. A balanced fund is a mutual fund that is invested in stocks and bonds, different types of stocks and bonds. They were looking at the monthly returns for those. They also looked at 10 years of quarterly returns from 58 pension funds, and they came to the conclusion that asset allocation accounts for 90% of the variability of returns, which is what the B. Bauer Brinson study did. They also found that about 40% return variation between funds is due to asset allocation, which supports the Janky study. But at the end of the day, us as investors, we're variation of returns, variation of returns between investments. That's not really what we want to focus on. Our approach with our practices has always been, what is our net return? After I pay taxes, after I pay fees, after you adjust for inflation, what did I really earn? And is that enough for me to make it with my retirement plan? So it comes for us, it always comes back to the retirement plan, which then ties into what rate of return do I need to earn in order to make my retirement plan work, and then help me build that portfolio that can achieve with high probability that return and take on the least amount of risk. I mean, it's the KISS theory. I mean, it comes back to the retirement plan that we talk about so often.
Well, it certainly is the plan, and we often do approach it from a end result, and end result back to the beginning, because the end result is, regardless of age, whether you're 20, 40, or 60, or in retirement, what type of return are you going to need to achieve your dreams, your goals, your realities? And that's where we start with our financial planning software. How much money do you need starting at today or a particular point in the future to last? And the unknown is how long are you going to live? But we plan typically at least to age 90, because that is going to account for probably 80 or 85% of the population. But we can extend that out easily to age 100 if you like, if you have good longevity, if you need that particular income by and factoring in a real rate of inflation. How much money do you have to earn on your portfolio once you've accumulated and you're into the decumulation phase? How much do you have to earn on the portfolio to make sure that you don't run out of money over that period of time? And quite honestly, it's a little bit different way of approaching it than many financial planners, because they try and determine your risk tolerance, which you must do. They try and determine what type of asset allocation to put you in to get what they consider a reasonable rate of return. But what's reasonable? I have a client right now where the financial planning software says that they could achieve a higher rate of return than they currently have in their portfolio because they're in what would be more of a capital preservation type of portfolio situation. But the reality of it is they don't need it. They have sufficient assets. They have sufficient income to provide all of their needs, even if they live to age 100, without exposing themselves to the risk. So how much money do you need if it's a 6% return or 7% or 8%? If it's an 8%, you're going to have to take on more risk. That's the fact of the matter. I had a client the other day who indicated that, you know, they achieved a 5, 6% rate of return over the last few years. And it's like, well, you know, the news says the S&P 500 did this, the NASDAQ did that, you know, the Dow did whatever. How come I only got this particular rate of return? And it all goes back to because that was what was compatible with your risk tolerance. The statements were, I don't want to lose any money. And if you don't want to lose...
But I want all the return.
But I want all the return. I don't want to lose any money. So if you wanted a greater return, then we have to take on more risk, which in turn exposes you to the fact that you will at some point lose money or your portfolio will decline, and you have to be willing to accept that to take on the higher return and higher risk. So I would agree with that. And calculating asset allocation, and we'll come back a little more to the active versus passive investment. But I was at a continuing education program yesterday where State Street Advisors was there, and they were talking about, you know, their new method of investing. And, you know, State Street was, of course, the creator, I guess, of the exchange-traded fund. I hadn't realized it's been around as long as it has, but they claim the fame of being coming out with the first ETF, fund for investment. And they've narrowed down, or they've attempted to develop a portfolio that would allow them to take advantage of, imagine this, John, both active and passive investment. So a portion of their portfolio is actively managed, and a portion of the portfolio is passively managed. And now their philosophy is that that will give you the best rate of return.
And the reason for that, the active component, active managers contend that through their research, their models, whatever it may be, that they can outperform an underlying index based on something called arbitrage, based on something called information, whatever it may be. Now, I will contend there are probably some asset categories where active management does have a better chance of outperforming than in other categories. For example, the S&P 500, if you're a large cap money manager and you're going to benchmark against the S&P 500, I contend that you're going to have a really hard time discovering information that isn't already known. So they're making decisions, should I have Coke or Pepsi, should I have Ford or GM, whatever it may be, to build out my portfolio. I'm just not sure that over the long term that can be accomplished. Now, I'm sure I am going to get hammered with emails and phone calls, whatever it may be, from active managers that may be listening. I have some friends that are active portfolio managers, but I think over the long term, you're going to struggle to find a manager that can actually beat the index net, because you have to back out the fees, because you're going to be paying more fees to the active manager than you would the index fund. A good example, Bill Miller, he ran the Legg Mason Value fund, and he contended for the longest time that he had, 10 years running, that he beat the S&P 500. He was, superior to it. If you look at his performance, the only time he beat the index was on the calendar year. So at the end of the year, he would clean up his portfolio and beat the index. Also, when you look at that track record, from year one to year 10, the margin that he beat the index over the calendar year period got smaller and smaller to where it was almost negligible once you got further out, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. If you were to run a February to February analysis, March to March, whatever it may be, other than that calendar year, he did not beat the underlying index. So again, now if you could say, okay, emerging markets where, some sort of specialty type of investment, active management may make sense, because if you have a manager that's dedicated to doing the research in those countries that are not followed by a lot of people, companies that are in those countries that are not followed by a lot, take Africa, for example, you may have a chance to outperform. What the Ibbotson Kaplan study said was, their summary, their conclusion of their study, which was, does asset allocation policy explain 40, 90, or 100% of performance? They came back and said, and because the average of all investors is the market itself, with good and bad managers canceling each other out, the asset allocation ultimately accounts for 100% of the absolute level of return, just like the Bebauer, Brinson, and Hood study had suggested. Now, I also found a piece from the CFA Institute, which is the Chartered Financial Analyst, the CFA. That's a designation, a very grueling 3-year proposition to get that designation. But your money managers, your mutual fund managers, and so forth are going to be CFAs for the most part. This gentleman said, determining an investor's appropriate asset allocation most often begins with an examination of their risk and return objectives, just like Larry talked about. The optimal asset allocation will also be largely dependent on the capital market assumptions made regarding asset class returns, risks, and correlation. So that ties to what kind of model are they using? What are the assumptions in that model? In theory, it is a matter of finding a spot on the efficient frontier. That's, when we say efficient frontier, that means optimal portfolio. So for a given level of risk, you can expect a maximum return. The risk-return trade-off is at the core of modern portfolio theory, which ties back to Harry Markowitz, his article from 1952. Besides the investor's tolerance for risk and their return expectations, other important considerations are liquidity needs, taxes, and time horizon. Folks, everything that I just talked about is a financial plan, or everything that this CFA just talked about is a financial plan. All those elements, liquidity needs, taxes, time horizon, risk, portfolio asset allocation, and so forth, all goes into your financial plan. You have to fill out a questionnaire. You have to tell your advisor, these are my dreams. This is what I want to accomplish. Here's, you know, my age. Here's my income. Here's how much I have in savings. All those things flow into your financial plan, which then, in our case, the last thing we do is figure out what the asset allocation is. Most advisors will start with the asset allocation, get you invested, and then everything else comes after that. We believe that the financial plan should be done first, which will help you determine what your portfolio should look like, essentially how much stock or how much risk you should be taking now to meet those goals and objectives, and then what your portfolio should look like once you enter retirement, because you're going to be more conservative. It's more capital preservation at that point versus growth. It's income producing versus growth. So taking those two portfolios into account, for us, you know, that's where we end the analysis and then get you implemented from that point. There was also another study. Oh, you know what I also noticed, Larry, too, which was interesting. I forgot to mention this.
What's that, John?
When I was doing this research and looking for materials to with the Bebauer-Brinson study and all that, when I put in the search active versus passive management, all the articles and studies that supported active management, guess who did those?
I don't know. The active managers.
They came back from mutual fund companies, money management companies. The actual article in the Financial Planning magazine, Why Active Investing Matters, was done by American funds.
Of course.
So all the passive studies were done by academics.
Imagine
universities,
that.
Things like that. So I thought that was a little... quite interesting. But anyway, I did find one which was done in 2006. It's called The Asset Allocation Debate, Provocative Questions, Enduring Realities. And you know who did this one? Think of a mutual fund company that has active as well as a lot of index funds.
Oh, Vanguard, of course.
Vanguard did this one. And we do use a lot of Vanguard ETFs in our portfolios, in full disclosure, but that does not mean what we're talking about here was an article that they did, which I thought they did a really good job. So what they came back with was, although active management can create significant performance variation, the degree of skill required to justify active management is very high. 50, and they have a chart here which talks about essentially 56% of balanced funds underperform their policy portfolios. That would be the asset allocation, the investment policy statement, on an annual basis over a 15-year period. 58% underperformed over 3 and 5 year. Since actively managed funds tend to have smaller market capitalizations than their respective benchmarks, the percentages reported may vary due in part to benchmark comparison issues. Financial theory and empirical evidence show that exposure to risk is compensated over time. Active management risk is not compensated on average, and that was from William Sharpe in 1991. However, it is compensated if skill overcomes the higher cost hurdle of active management. So it was a pretty fair and balanced study. It's only 10 or 11 pages, but they went on to say... Let's go over to this page. Janke was the first to point out that the investment industry's interpretation of the Brinson study, namely its conclusion that index statistics, asset allocation policy, is the optimal approach for investors. Only if investors have the ability. Only if investors have the ability to predict expected returns in financial markets can dynamic or tactical asset allocation enhance portfolio performance. So what Vanguard essentially has done was they said, okay, if you have an asset allocation and you have an IPS or a policy that's tied to that, will changing that allocation over time based on life events produce better results? And it came back, yes.
That makes sense.
So, folks, this is exactly what your financial advisor should be doing for you, is they come up with an asset allocation, and then they make little tweaks based on life events. You know, we have some clients that we are reducing their equity exposure because we've had a pretty good run-up. They have, you know, it's time to make their portfolio a little bit more conservative. Another approach that we've taken is in the large-cap value space. Our portfolio for the longest time was excluding financial stocks because interest rates were so low. But now that interest rates are bumping up, we have added an all-inclusive dividend type fund, which includes financial stocks. They are the little tweaks that we're doing. So also determine that changes in allocation over time improves overall returns and lowers volatility. So I contend, based on all these different studies, the readings that I've done, the Vanguard summary, which did a great job, again, that is called The Asset Allocation Debate, Provocative Questions, Enduring Realities, that, and this was in 2006, clearly indicates that asset allocation is the determinant of investment returns to a high degree, certainly above 90%, the variability above returns as well as the overall return. And a lot of this other stuff that everyone tries to sell, market timing, now's the time to get in, now's the time to get out. Stock selection, we have the best model, we can pick the best. Luck has just as much probability as market timing. Stock select. So you're talking about a very small percentage of the actual your actual portfolio's return is attributed to those things. And get back to the KISS theory. Keep it simple,
it's
stupid.
It's the old time in the market, not timing the market, that relates to
You've
this.
You've been dying to drop that one.
I know. I've been holding that one down. And if you go out there and Investopedia is our friend, they indicate the debate about the two approaches, passive versus active, actually goes back to the early 1970s. And of course, as you've indicated already, supporting the passive management argument are the researchers from the nation's universities, privately funded research centers, and like, whereas Wall Street firms, banks, insurance companies, and other companies that have a vested interest in profits from active management support the other side of the coin. And each one can make a logically strong case to support their arguments, although in many cases, their support is due to a different belief system, much like opposing political parties. You know, people believe strongly in active, and American Funds certainly has a strong story to tell about active management over the years. But active management also can create more volatility because the fact that the manager is trying to beat the underlying index can result in some cases making the wrong decisions and therefore introducing anomalies or losses that are not part of a particular index or a result. So it goes back to my favorite answer dealing with investment-related questions and financial planning, John. And you know what that is?
No.
It depends. Because it depends. Realistically, your portfolio has to reflect you. It has to reflect your family.
Your needs.
Your needs, your goals, your objectives, your dreams. And quite honestly, they change. One of my clients recently, one of my better positioned clients recently was anticipating when they could retire. And actually, they could retire today without any problem. They've accumulated enough assets. They have no debt. They plan on doing some travel and some different things. They both still work. But the question is, can I retire yet? And the answer has been and continues to be yes, whenever you want to retire. About a year ago, one of the two in the family unit was diagnosed with cancer. Well, that throws a whole different light on your financial plan because fortunately he is cancer-free at this point, but it puts a whole new perspective on maybe I don't have 30 years to enjoy what I put away for retirement. Maybe it's 5 years. Maybe it's 2 years. Maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's, you know, more immediate. So our plan hopes for the best, but we have to also plan for the worst case scenario. And family situations, health certainly can be a major factor in determining what you do and how you do your asset allocation, because I agree it does account for at least 90% of the results of your performance. You know, if you're going to be in all stable value and bond funds, you're not going to significantly beat inflation. If you're going to be in all equities, you're going to have a lot of volatility. And if that volatility is at the wrong time, that can be a major impact into your ability to retire. So it is a planning process. It's something that we go through. And as John indicated, we tweak, we adjust along the way as your environment changes. You know, interest rates change in terms of investing. The world economy changes, and also the situation in the markets. Certainly political parties have a major impact on where the market is and where it's going. Unfortunately, neither one of us have a crystal ball to be able to tell you which way it's going, but caution sometimes is the better part of reality in terms of adjusting a portfolio to make the most of your goals and objectives. So back to you, Jen.
When I was in college, I had my portfolio theory professor. He had tenure. His name was Herbert Phillips. He was actually a student of Harry Markowitz at the University of Chicago. So you could say I'm a second-generation Markowitz kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But two stories or two things that I learned in his class, other than all the quantitative analysis and so forth. One of his comments was, you as a financial advisor, when you go out into the world, can do more damage to an individual than a doctor. You know, a doctor could make a mistake here and there, but, you know, the person can live, can find a different job, can, you know, he was trying to say that, you know, if you go in and you start getting crazy with your investments and that person loses all their money, a widow who is completely living on her investments loses all of her money and she becomes homeless. Now, granted, he was taking things to extremes, but he was trying to make a point. Hey, you need to be pay attention to what you're doing. The second thing that I learned from him was, other than that his class was incredibly difficult, that he had created a model, and he told us this story, a couple of us that were hanging around after class one day. He had created a model, and it was a buy-hold model. So that means it was similar to the Efficient Frontier. But he had tweaked that model and was trying to then sell it. So he went up to New York, from Philadelphia up to New York, to a very large mutual fund investment company, went into the room and started talking about his model. The head of the meeting at that time stopped him probably 10 minutes into the discussion, 15 minutes into his presentation, and said, how do you account for trading? And he said, this is a buy-hold model. And his response was, we don't make money. We make money by trading. Thank you for your time. And he got up and left, and my professor pretty much knew that he was stuck to academia. So that kind of gives you an idea that a lot of these investment shops and so forth, they are interested in obviously making money. The asset allocation approach is very difficult for them to do that. However, over time, things have changed, and you're getting now allocation managers that charge a fee for allocating portfolios and so forth and make money that way. At the end of the day, I think that's better for clients because all these studies that I've went through clearly prove that asset allocation is the driver. And since asset allocation is the driver, market timing and stock selection and so forth are very small parts of this, it comes back to passive investing. Passive investing with asset allocation, and then tweaking the allocation based on needs or wants. You know, as Larry alluded to, if you know you become sick or you have a really good run up in the market, you know, do we tweak the allocation or some of the other different ways that we talked about there? So with that, we have 10 minutes left.
We do. And the only thing I would potentially add to that in terms of investing is, it depends. you have different situations in the market. I have clients who, you know, they have their pool of assets that they have in retirement, and their goal is, I don't care what you do or how you do it, but I don't want to lose what I have. And that's an approach that we have to take into account in terms of asset allocation, as well as their risk tolerance, and making sure that, as we've talked about in other shows, that all of the legal documents are in place to, you know, designate beneficiaries properly, to make sure and suggest that they've met with their attorney to complete their powers of attorney for health care, as well as durable goods and their wills, potentially their trusts, and that things are handled properly in terms of legal matters. Because when the day is done, it's whatever has been done in terms of completed and signed documents is going to direct how your assets are allocated down the road. So, again, thanks to the Chef Shop, both Nancy and Scott Schneider. Scott, as I mentioned before, a fellow grad of the Mass Communications Department here at SIU Edwardsville, WSIE. I won't tell you when he was out here and when I was out here, but it was a while ago. We are celebrating our 47th year now on the air, so I may give you some slight indication. But thanks to both of them for underwriting the show, helping us out. Great coffee, always. Enjoy the candy, enjoy the popcorn that they have, as well as all of the other stuff. They do go out of their way. They take the extra step in terms of recognizing their clients and thanking them for doing business with them. And they're just good people. So go by and talk to them, see them, see what they have. And John, you know what's coming in 7 days? 7 days from now, it's a rhetorical question. 7 days from now is coming up on the Department of Labor. Actually, it's less than that. The show airs. It's going to be in 2 days. The Department of Labor.
About taxes.
April 15th is upon us too. But the Department of Labor decision, which as of the airing of the show, may or may not have been decided if the fiduciary rule is going to go into effect.
I thought they delayed it.
So it has not officially been delayed. The request has gone to.
They're taking questions and comments.
Well, they are taking questions and comments. It as late as yesterday was referred to the Office of Budget and Management, the OBM, and if they rule that they are going to accept the delay, it'll be delayed until probably June or maybe beyond. And if not, there's going to be a lot of changes. I would say that as an investor, you need to have the conversation with your financial advisor. How are they going to meet the needs of the fiduciary rule? Is paying a fee for investing the best way for you to reach your goals and objectives? Or are you positioned to take advantage of passive investment in terms of having enough money to not pay any upfront loads and whatnot? Know what your costs are. That's the bottom line. Know what your fees are, what you're paying for investment advice. And if it is indeed in your best interest, meeting your goals and objectives, then you should be okay.
All right. Stupid news stories.
Okay.
Now, I know you are a big fan of stupid criminals.
I am.
And not to make light of somebody dying, but are you familiar with the Darwin Awards?
I am not.
The Darwin Awards have been around since 1994. Essentially, what they do is they collect stories of people that have done absolutely asinine, stupid things and died. And what they came up with for their 20-year anniversary when they were doing all this, a 20-year study of all the Darwin Awards, there were 318 valid cases that they were able to prove actually happened. Okay. Because a lot of people submit stuff that, you know, aren't the fake news.
Fake news, yeah.
But, ladies, this comment here is for you. Men really are more stupid than women, research shows. So of the 318 valid cases, 282, or essentially 90% of the awards given out by the Darwin Award Committee, if you will, were to males, just 36 to females.
Why does that not surprise me?
So what I did was I then have gone back and read through the winners for each year. And in 1995, and I've also picked stories that were not in our area because I was trying to avoid, you know, upsetting anyone because, again, death is, it's a serious issue.
Tough topic.
But when you do things this stupid, sometimes removing you from the gene pool may be a good thing.
Yeah,
just
maybe.
Saying, folks.
Go ahead. All right.
But anyway, in 1995, so-and-so from such-and-such place died while attempting to repair his truck from underneath it while it was still in motion. So what he did was reported that this person had asked a friend to drive his truck on a highway while he clung to its undercarriage in an ill-fated attempt to work out the source of a funny noise that it kept making.
I have nothing to say about that, John. Absolutely nothing.
And since we didn't get to talk about or do this topic last show because we got so wrapped up in April Fool's stuff, I have another one. In 2000, so-and-so from such a place died attempting to play Russian roulette. Are you familiar with Russian roulette?
I am, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That is where you grab a revolver, you stick a single bullet in the revolver, you spin the revolver, close it, pull the trigger, and hope that the bullet was not lined up to be fired when you shot it. However, this person played Russian roulette with a semi-automatic pistol.
Not smart people.
So there are my two stories. I have a whole bunch of them that I'll probably work out for a little while because
Yeah, let's not go there. Wow. I give you a little on a lighter note. You know, you've heard of karma, haven't you, John?
I have.
Well, karma is one of those things that just comes around and bites you. You know,
yes.
And it, well, yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but okay. And in this particular case, a gentleman who was working as a bouncer. This was in, as the story relates, in Iowa City, Iowa. He was working at as a bouncer at a bar in that area. And a month or two earlier, he had noticed that his driver's license had been stolen. And he, you know, couldn't locate it, didn't know what he did with it, he'd leave it somewhere, what wasn't, what not. And one evening, he was working at the bar as a bouncer when an individual came up and presented his license to him as proof of age. And needless to say, it did not go well. He did get his license back, and the individual is now in jail. So stupid
wow.
Criminals. You know? But karma was that one. You know, had to be at the right place at the right time to be subject to that. So as we wrap things up, a minute or two to go, thanks again to the Chef Shop for underwriting the show. Thanks to WSIE, Steve Jankowski, and Daryl for putting up with us for so long. We have enjoyed sharing some information on the financial area of expertise that we have. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please send us your questions to LLEXOW, nickelfinancial.com. That's NICOL, financial.com. Or John Graney, that's JGRANEY, at nickelfinancial.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thanks to WSIE as well as the university for giving us the opportunity to share a little information with you on the Financial Cafe. Go to our website, The Financial Cafe. It's www.thefinancialcafe.us. Lots of good stuff out there on our blog as well. And I guess we'll wrap it up at that point, John. Say goodbye, John.
Goodbye, John.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nickelfinancial.com or to Larry at lexo@nickelfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private. Thanks for listening to the Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.